Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Today, you're going to meet Jonathan Ophir. He's an Israeli expatriate, served in the military in Israel, and he writes frequently at MondoWeiss.net, where he expresses what I consider to be rational criticism of the government of the State of Israel. We're going to cover a lot of ground in the next 45 minutes or so, talking about Obama, Trump, Netanyahu, and recent events, including the truck ramming in Jerusalem that was mischaracterized as an attack by the Islamic State. That's all ahead. And as you'll hear, we're tipping our hat to listener and subscriber Ian Berman, who suggested to me that I conduct this interview with Jonathan Ophir. Thanks, Ian. Other subscribers include Tim McKay, Susan Gavet, Terry Paris, and Carla Mahoney. I'd like you to join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the link that says menu, then become a subscriber. It takes you to the sign-up page where you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. And our $50 annual subscription can earn you a bonus book. They're depicted right there on the sign-up page at peterbcollins.com. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, some fascinating perspectives on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute from Jonathan Ophir.
Nature's weak, telling you something's wrong. It's nature's weak, telling you in a song.
And we must credit at the outset here listener, subscriber, and longtime activist Ian Berman, who suggested that I connect with Jonathan Ophir. Jonathan is a fascinating guy. He's Israeli. He served in the IDF. He is a professional musician and conductor, currently living in Denmark. And he contributes frequently to the website where I get the best information about Israel and Palestine, MondoWeiss.net. Jonathan, thanks for being with me by Skype today.
Yeah, thank you very much, Peter. Pleasure.
Let's learn a little bit about you. Professional musician and conductor, what's your instrument, and what are you doing in Denmark?
my instrument is, main instrument is violin, but I actually had to stop performing professionally some 5 years ago due to neurological problems, so I went over to conducting, and hopefully I can get back to playing. Mm-hmm. I've been in Denmark for the past 21 years. I came here, you know, for quite trivial romantic reasons, and you know, stayed ever since.
Uh-huh.
Kids here and everything.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
And describe your attitude toward the State of Israel. I don't wish to put any words in your mouth or characterize your views, but as I mentioned, you served in the Israeli Defense Force, as citizens are required to. And I find you to be a very rational critic of the policies of the State of Israel.
Okay, I appreciate that. Many will not share your feelings. Yes, that's already a start, you know, talking about Israel. You just say the word and, you know, there's 30 different opinions. And you know, I flew a few years ago with a woman who was Palestinian. She was going there, so to speak, and I asked her about it, and for her, she was going to Palestine. You know, she was not going to Israel. So even the names of the place are contentious. So my feeling about Israel, well, you know, my feelings about Israel have changed quite radically during the years. I mean, I come from a kibbutz, you know, kind of communal, typically leftist, your liberal socialist society, you know, defined by the mainstream, you know, Zionist left. Mm-hmm. And I basically, you know, didn't question those ideals I was brought up with until a very late age, more or less, you know, more or less, I would say about 8 years ago, really. And, you know, our society, whilst it was socialist, you know, you shouldn't be fooled that it was just about peace, love, and equality. I mean, it was a very militaristic society. I mean, if you look at kibbutz, it's been changing a bit, but historically, kibbutz members were disproportionately represented in combat units, and also in the numbers of deaths. So if I should just give you a very stark example, when my uncle died, for example, in the 1973 October War in Sinai, in fact, he was in the unit with former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, mm-hmm. elite commando unit. So he died, and eight men from the kibbutz had died in that war out of, I believe it was 180 who were called up to that war. So you understand it was and we're talking about a kibbutz of a few hundred people. Well, now it's maybe around 1,000, but, you know, it's a very big proportion of the population. So all this ethos of war and sacrifice, that played a huge part in, you know, in my upbringing and so on. So that was, you know, my feeling until of quite late age. And I didn't really question, you know, the issue of Zionism or the righteousness of, you know, Zionism, that those questions. I didn't really come to question them until, you know, some years ago. And when I did, and I think one of the things that actually, you know, caused a very serious cut in my life was actually simply reading Ilan Pappe's book, The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, which I read just very shortly after it came out in 2006. I read it in 2007. And that brought me to question a whole lot of things and narratives that I was brought up with.
Let me just interject. Do you regard the policies of the State of Israel in general as apartheid?
I do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been writing about that. And I think I go even further than to regard apartheid just in the you know, Palestinian occupied territories, as, you know, nowadays, you know, many do that, many relate to that. And, you know, Israeli journalist Gideon Levy mm-hmm. will say that, and people will talk about that. It's not something that is not being said anymore. It's not just something that Jimmy Carter will talk about. It's not just something that Desmond Tutu will talk about. It's something that is talked about, but a lot of people just, you know, related to the paradigm that is in those occupied territories, you know, where one population has rights and roads, even mm-hmm. exclusive roads and so on, and another population does not in the same territory. That it's a very stark reality there. But I'm also relating, you know, I go back. I think you could look at one of my earlier articles in Mondo-S. About a year ago, I wrote about what's the difference between the 1967 occupation and the 1948 occupation. And I, you know, I do regard that 1948 was an occupation, which of course included a massive ethnic cleansing. There was a quite very big ethnic cleansing also in 1967, which many people, I think, know much less about. Those are hundreds and thousands of people. But the famous, you know, the famous ethnic cleansing is, of course, in 1948. And even that term, you know, if we had talked like 10 years ago, this would be totally contentious.
Right.
Nowadays, even, you know, people like centrist Zionists like Ari Shavit say the term, you know, ethnic cleansing.
Mm-hmm.
So I regard, you know, 1948 as an occupation, and it also included almost two decades of military regime upon those Palestinians, very similar to what we've seen since 1967 in those occupied territories. So there, and in addition, there is, you know, if you look at the Adala database, they have collected like about 50 discriminatory laws that are not in occupied territories, but in what we call Israel proper.
Mm-hmm.
They are affecting citizens, non-Jewish citizens, that is particularly Palestinian or what is called in Israel Arab citizens of the state. And this is intrinsic racism, a kind of apartheid, which is less apparent and less visible than it is, of course, in the occupied territories, but still existent.
Well, the recent acts of the Knesset that diminish the rights of the non-Jewish members of the Knesset and subject them to expulsion, to me, are clear and recent indications of a dual policy that discriminates against those people based on their religion and ethnicity. And here's another baseline item for you, please, Jonathan. Here in the United States, we are repeatedly told that Israel is our only and longest ally in the region, and that it's the only democracy, and therefore, you know, we must give it special status and $38 billion over the next 10 years. And I regard Israel as much more of a theocracy, where the window dressing of a true democratic establishment is apparent. But when you look at the actual policies and the results, I feel that we are dealing with a theocratic government that is not, you know, certainly on a par with the theocracy in Iran. But I do consider it to be technically theocratic.
Yeah, I would agree. I would regard even that the basis of Zionism, you know, without, and in that I might be going further than others who just, you know, criticize Israeli contemporary policy. I would say that the basis of Zionism is a kind of theocratic basis. Some call it ethnocentric or ethnocratic basis, and it's very difficult to actually, you know, pinpoint or be very exact, because the whole basis of Zionism is actually regarding Judaism as a nation, you know, as a race. When you look at Judaism as a religion, you will have to call the Israeli model, you can appraise it as a theocratic model. From a Jewish Zionist, I would say Zionist perception, it's a kind of ethnocratic model. And it's basically saying that the law of return from 1950, if you are Jewish or have Jewish ancestry, they amended it in the 70s, and now it's become like if you have a grandparent, just one grandparent, it's quite like alas, like the Nuremberg laws, actually.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a grandparent that is Jewish, then you are you can return even though you've never been there, and
right,
maybe your ancestors never have. On the other hand, if you know you were born there and you happen to be non-Jewish, then you will be subject to a whole lot of other problems and scrutiny, which can reach the level of, as you say, well, expulsion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a model which is like this. So I'm saying, if you're talking about democracy and, you know, how Israel is regarded, I have to, you know, differ fundamentally on that from the outset, you know, from the outset of Israel, that, I mean, you have to ask the question, can a democracy be based on such premises where one population, which is not even the population, it's the supposed ethnicity or nationality of Jews everywhere from the whole world, it supersedes the rights of people who actually live there. And I, again, sorry not to be self-promotional, but I wrote an article, you can find it also on MondeWise, that Israelis don't exist. And it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like a crazy claim, right? But the thing is that there is no Israeli nationality. The Israel has about 130 something nationalities that it recognizes. Amongst them is the Jewish nationality, but it doesn't have an Israeli nationality. You wouldn't know it if you looked at our passports, because if you look at my passport, it says nationality Israeli, right? But those people, and I'm this is actual fact. You know, there have been several attempts to recognize an Israeli nationality in our ID registry. And those who have tried it have all received the standard response that Israel does not has decided not to recognize an Israeli nationality. And the reason, of course,
so then John, what is your heritage? What would be your alternate?
Well, it's a kind of void, yeah. Mm-hmm. In the absence of a nationality, you only have citizenship, Israeli citizenship. But what is then the function of this recognition of nationality? Well, it's a little bit hidden, and I think Jonathan Cook also appraises it, journalist Jonathan Cook, he also appraises it very nicely. In the absence, in that void, where you don't have an Israeli nationality, the fact that that Israel is called and officially calls itself the Jewish state, that means that those who are Jews are preserved rights, privileges that are closest to actually being real Israelis, whilst no one is an Israeli. Because if everyone were Israelis, they would have to be equal citizens. And that's how Israel avoids it.
I see. Interesting. We're talking with Jonathan Ophir. He's a frequent contributor to MondoWeiss.net. And Jonathan, I want to get your comments on this truck attack that occurred in Jerusalem on the 8th of January. Because as you noted in a post that you wrote, the Netanyahu government is very good at propaganda. That's my view. You didn't say that.
Yeah, I agree.
And the first breaking news of this story included hysterical claims by Benjamin Netanyahu personally that this was an operation of the Islamic State. And it may turn out to be true, it may not. But I knew when I first heard it that he didn't have proof, but he was going to frame this event as terrorism. There was no acknowledgement that the truck driver himself died. We only talked about the Israeli victims. They were described as boys, even though they were of military age and were serving.
Young Israelis, yeah.
Yeah, they were on duty and in uniform, as I understand it. And so I find this to be fascinating. And people say, Peter, you know, you never say anything good about Netanyahu. And what I will say is he's a very skilled manipulator of impressions and perceptions and a master of propaganda. And as an example, I would use the coverage of the interception of the Mavi Marmara in international waters some years ago, where this was this was characterized by Israel as an assault on its forces. And these people who were wielding deck chairs and, you know, maybe a kitchen knife to try to fend off this invasion of their ship were characterized as the bad guys. And because of the initial framing of that, it held throughout the coverage of that event, right up through the finding that Israel acted improperly by raiding that ship in international waters and paid a settlement to the nation of Turkey. But with that as an opener, talk a little bit about your perception of how the Netanyahu government seized on this event and used it to advance its own aims.
Okay, Peter. Well, I mean, you took us to high seas with the Mavi Marmara, and that's a whole other story. And, you know, I would recommend Norman Finkelstein's appraisal of that. But we'll stick with the more current events. I understand why you're asking about it. Right. So I really completely agree, Peter. First of all, you know, we heard those rumors about ISIS. And if you look at what Netanyahu was saying, if you look at what Chief of Police Roni Elshiek was saying, if you look at what Defense Minister Lieberman were saying, you can see from between their words that they had really nothing. It's like, Netanyahu, you know, he says it's pictorial, you know, it's kind of metaphoric. You know, it's this terror wave that is coming from France and it goes through Germany and now it, you know, it kind of reached Israel. And then Roni Elshiek, he was saying, chief of police, he was saying, well, I don't know, you know, maybe the guy saw television and he saw ISIS on television and I don't really know what goes on in these people's heads, but it certainly can have an influence. You know, they were basically guessing. And Lieberman, defense minister, he was saying like, oh, we don't need excuses. You know, we don't need to guess. It's not about the settlements. It's not about occupation. It's about terror. You know, so it was very clear that they were trying to throw this off as far as possible first of all, relate it picturally with ISIS without a shred of evidence. And then they put a gag order on the thing, you know, in the evening. So we don't know anything. And as I was also appraising and I wrote a couple of times about it, we have a very disturbing precedence with Netanyahu and his propaganda. I mean, if you look 2 years, 2.5 years back to 2014, in the run-up to the Gaza onslaught in that summer, mm-hmm. you know, there was on June 13th there was a kidnap of three settler youths. Two were 16, one was 19, and these young men, they were kidnapped, and the Israel had an emergency recording which where they were calling for help, and then they could hear that there were shootings, and then silence, and then some chanting. So they knew pretty much, you know, pretty well that they were dead, but there was a gag order on that, and they were saying to the public that we're assuming they're alive and they're going to look after them. And that was a pretext for, you know, within 2 days, Netanyahu was saying Hamas is responsible. Hamas will pay. Mm-hmm. By the 26th, you know, a few weeks later, the police forgot his name, Miki Rosenberg, I think, Rosenfeld, head of police there, he said that it's pretty clear that Hamas was not involved. And in the end, it turned out, you know, that actually it was this rogue group from mm-hmm. around Al-Khalil, who or you call Hebron.
And Jonathan, let me underscore here the perniciousness of Netanyahu's game, because as you're pointing out, he knew for at least 2 weeks that those boys were dead. And he kept hammering, and he was pulling a page from the Boko Haram campaign. Bring home our boys, he kept saying. And, you know, this was used to generate hysteria, to create the perception of Israel as a victim. And that victimhood is something that is played, I think, magnificently to their advantage. And in general, it's a pure concoction. You know, he used that to get Obama to go silent when he proceeded to, quote-unquote, mow the lawn in Gaza, and thousands of people, including many children, were killed.
Yeah. Well, it's pretty clear that it was pretty clear to many at that point that Netanyahu was actually trying to ditch what could kind of ironically be called a Palestinian peace offensive. You know, in this respect, I'm quoting military analyst Avner Yaniv as he regards the 1982 Lebanon War as having the raison d'etre of of averting another Palestinian peace initiative, because there was an initiative in April 2014, and it was the unity government, and Hamas. It basically meant that Hamas was effectively conceding to parameters that everyone could work with. The quartet was willing to deal with Hamas, but you know, that would have meant that Israel had a pragmatic partner, but Netanyahu wouldn't have that. You know, that could mean peace. He said, you know, Abbas should choose between peace and Hamas, and he needed, you know, he needed to get something to work with to incite violence again. Norman Finkelstein, I quote him a lot. He says that, you know, Netanyahu got that gift in the form of that kidnapping, and then he basically used it to crack down massively on Hamas, like I think it was about 1,500 locations in the West Bank, arresting about 350 people or leaders, or maybe it was up to 500, something around that area.
Yeah.
Almost all the leaders of Hamas in the West Bank, and you know, rearresting people who were basically released on the Gilad Shalit deal in 2011, just, you know, randomly kind of rearresting them. And keeping them for a long time, so it's in detention. So it was basically an opportunity for Netanyahu to totally change subject. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, let's return to the recent ramming attack in Jerusalem that we're talking about here in January. So we talked about ISIS. And the ISIS allegation, we don't know. But what we do know is that, it worked.
Let me ask you to comment, because there has been some speculation that Netanyahu seized on this at the point where investigators were getting closer to him on corruption charges. And secondarily, that this occurred in the aftermath of the historic, but almost meaningless, because it came so late in the Obama term, decision not to veto the Security Council resolution, and then John Kerry's speech, where he finally unloaded honestly about just how obstructionist Netanyahu has been over the last few years. And I view the amped-up response to the truck ramming in Jerusalem as a way to try to regain control of the message and the agenda, and a way to distract or distort these other events.
Peter, personally, I don't like to put too much weight on speculations, but you know, it's permissible, and we can see the chain of events. In general, I share your view there. I think we need to get to the other part of the picture that was painted by Netanyahu beyond ISIS, because this very much relates to the issue you're talking about, because Yeah, Israel was in a very bad PR situation, both the UN and Kerry. I personally see Kerry's speech there as relatively tepid, and and I have criticized it a lot. You know, I Kerry with interruptions. I did one article and so on several times, but nonetheless, you know, from Israel's standpoint, it was losing its losing ground, and what happened was, okay, we're talking about this truck ramming. Now this happened in East Jerusalem. Okay, this is an occupied territory. This was a person who was an East Jerusalemite, a Palestinian, an occupied person, and he was ramming soldiers, as you said, in uniform, armed soldiers. Never, you know, the Israeli press said, stressed that they were not combat cadets and so on. That doesn't really matter. We can't demand, you know, from a person theoretically to know that or to have to even regard that in terms of the right to resist occupation. So I was basically claiming this, you know, the claim of terror here is very problematic. Apparently, the whole setting seems to fall rather squarely into the legitimate resistance of terror of occupation, sorry, that is permitted by, you know, standard international law. But if you look at it from Israel's standpoint, it's the united united capital, right? Jerusalem. So it's not occupied. Israel annexed that territory unilaterally. No country in the world accepts that. No country in the world sees it that way, although Trump does, but, you know, and the UN has just confirmed that it's illegal, and that the settlements are a flagrant violation. In fact, it's effectively saying it's a war crime with the settlement. So it's reflecting on the whole occupation as illegal. And this all happens right there. So if Netanyahu calls it terror, he's also deflecting from the focus upon the occupation, upon the settlements, upon Israel's control from 67. He's deflecting it all, and he's putting it all on another table, which he then calls ISIS. Mm-hmm. So I agree that, you know, the whole thing fits perfectly well with an agenda to simply deflect that criticism. And if anyone wants to then consider, you know, peaceful solutions under more kind of, you know, under international uncontroversial parameters like the Paris conference, which I told you I didn't look at it in detail, but it you know, their declaration is saying, is talking about the 1967 lines and UN 242 and 338, you know, it's all the conventional stuff about the parameters for a peace in the region. If anyone talks about that, you know, Netanyahu just throws it off to say, look, we're facing terror. You can't talk about these things.
Yeah. And Jonathan, let's take a moment here for a couple of things. One is to get your characterization of the Obama 8 years and his struggles with Netanyahu. My description is that Obama reduced U.S. support for Israel from 1,000% to about 950%. But Netanyahu acted as if, you know, Obama had declared war on the state of Israel and identified it as a great enemy. And so I'd like to hear your characterization of not the personalities, but the way the policies played out and the tensions between the U.S. and Israel.
Yeah, well, I would say in general that Netanyahu's response to Obama and, you know, Israel's response to the Obama administration in these past 8 years has said much more about Israel and its state and where it has come than it has actually about Obama. Because the Obama administration, I mean, they even boast about it. You know, Kerry even boasts about it. They have been the most Israel-supportive administration arguably ever. Obama has, you know, a lot of people have talked about this abstention in the recent UN resolution condemning settlements 2334 about this abstention as something historic. It's not historic. It's hysterically non-historic. I mean, you look at Reagan, he passed 21 Security Council resolutions, which were taking Israel to task, you know, for its behavior towards Palestinians or its Arab neighbors. Every president before Obama has done more, has passed more resolutions. You know, Clinton and Obama has the Obama administration under the Obama administration. The U.S. has vetoed that earlier version of that resolution in 2011.
Right.
So it hasn't passed it. It was another draft, but then it let it go in the very, very end of Obama's administration. So one resolution that U.S. abstained on, he has been more supportive to Israel than in that, you know, even by those parameters, than any president before him since 1967, if we're talking about that. So it's very strange in that way, you know, and again, he's just given, you know, the raise in the military budget. So Israel gets more than half of the U.S. military aid globally.
And Jonathan, I don't want to sound like Trump here, but that was a really bad deal. I mean, I take as given that the U.S. was going to respond to Netanyahu's extortion and cough up more money as an offset to the Iran deal. I don't approve of that. But if such a deal is going to be made, the U.S. should have gotten more for it. And so to see these recriminations after the increase in the aid with no strings attached over what is really, a resolution that will not have long-term impact at the UN, I found to be almost laughable, except, of course, lives are at stake and the occupation grinds on. But let me turn to your view of the incoming Trump administration and his nominated ambassador, David Friedman, who's his bankruptcy lawyer. And Friedman is not only pro-settlement, he has been a philanthropist to illegal settlements. He wants to move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a real poke in the eye to the Palestinians. So this is shaping up to be, an administration that is over the top supportive of Israel and will actually, I think, do more to align our foreign policy with the interests of the state of Israel than Obama did. And I felt he did way too much along those lines. So how do you see the next year or two shaping up with Trump coming in?
Yeah, well, that's a very big area. I'll try to be succinct. People were wondering a few months ago when half a year ago when Trump was saying that he'll be the neutral guy on Israel, right? Will he really be the neutral guy? And of course, Hillary Clinton used that against him. And this is quite egregious when you think about it in her AIPAC speech. He was actually mocking him for suggesting to be neutral on Israel. You don't go neutral on Israel.
Right.
Being neutral is not good. You don't go neutral on Israel. But people were wondering, will he really be? But I think that with lining up of his people that we are seeing now, you are mentioning David Friedman. I would also mention his son-in-law, Jared Kushner.
Yeah.
He's lining up some seriously ultra-nationalist, pro-settlement, far-right Jews. Don't call me an anti-Semite just because I mentioned they're Jews. And it's becoming pretty clear what's going to happen there. See, Dave, you're right. David Friedman, he's not just a normal philanthropist. He's actually on the board of directors of this support committee for Beit El. That's his baby. That's his favorite settlement. He fundraises like about $2 million a year for that settlement. In fact, I would also point this out, and people should pay attention to this, because actually Donald Trump himself has been donating to the Beit El settlement. And I think this was back in 2003, $10,000. Judy Maltz in Haaretz mentioned it a month ago. Maybe there's more, I don't know. But he has been, and you know, it's said that he did that in honor of David Friedman. But who cares? You know, in fact, effectively, Donald Trump has been donating to war crimes. David Friedman, he is a supporter of these settlements, which are effectively war crimes. And the people in Beit El, they're just celebrating now. You know, their spokesperson, she's saying, we think, you know, he'll be actually our ambassador to the United States, you understand? He'll be their man, you know. And it's not just Beit El. Beit El is just, you know, one of those settlements. Friedman made it a very big settlement, but it represents, you know, the settlement enterprise. And this is Friedman's baby in a nutshell. Mm-hmm. And yes, he's going to put, I don't know if they're really going to move the embassy, and you know, there are speculations about whether Trump will really want to do that and have that occupy all his time because of the mayhem that is going to arise from making such a move. Mm-hmm. But certainly, you know, they're lining up to push for a total legalization and endorsement of the Israeli settlement. And I was mentioning Jared Kushner, who is Donald Trump's son-in-law, married to Ivanka, who has actually converted to Judaism.
Right.
It's funny because I don't know how many people saw the recent Al Jazeera coverage, The Lobby, which is groundbreaking, in fact, on UK, you know, basically insurgency of from the Israeli embassy into UK politics on Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But the mysterious agent there, who is, it's unclear whether he says he's not a career diplomat, and it's questionable whether he was even working for the embassy or maybe for the Ministry of Strategic Affairs and Hasbara. That's what it is officially. He's talking about Trump, and he's saying there at a certain point, you know, it's a bit, he's unpredictable. But then he mentions his daughter, Ivanka, who is a Jew, who converted to Judaism. And he mentions it like, okay, that's going to ensure it's going to make him solid on Israel. So, you know, it's this kind of nepotism, which is, it's kind of on the edge. They found some loophole, you know, his advisor found some loophole that makes it possible, because the Congress said, you know, despite the anti-nepotism law from 1960, the Congress has some precedents from, I think, 1978 or something, that says that the president doesn't have to abide by federal non-nepotism laws and so on. So, you know, he appoints Jared Kushner, a very young his son-in-law who helped him in his campaign and so on, but has virtually, you know, basically zero political experience. And he's going to be his special – he's tapped to be his special advisor – special advisor for the White House. So Jared Kushner, who is also, you know, his Kushner Foundation, he sits on the board of directors. I think he still does, or maybe he will stop because he's going into these politics. But he's been sitting on this fund, and this fund has not only been funding normal, if you will, you know, normal settlements. It's even been funding a settlement in Itzhar, which is so violent, you know, so ultra-nationalist, so violent that even the Israeli government has blocked, has stopped its funding of it, in 2011, since its people were attacking not only Palestinians, but even Israeli soldiers. So that's, you know, that's the level of Israeli ultra-nationalism that Donald Trump is lining up in relation to Israel.
Well, and he's such a thin-skinned and trivial guy. You probably heard that the Vatican has extended an ambassadorship arrangement to the Palestinian Authority. And Mahmoud Abbas was at the Vatican with Pope Francis to initiate this. So I imagine that in response, Trump will name Shmuley Boteish as the U.S. ambassador to the Vatican. And they can have some lovely pasta lunches there in Rome. Jonathan, as we wrap up here, I wanted to get your thoughts on the manslaughter trial of Sergeant Elor Azaria. And many Americans, many of my listeners saw the grisly footage as the sergeant dispatched by point-blank execution a Palestinian suspect who was lying on the ground unarmed and who, you know, made no move of any threatening nature. And first of all, it was not a murder trial. It was downgraded to manslaughter to start with. But I was actually quite surprised that the jury returned a guilty verdict, despite the open pandering of Netanyahu. Avigdor Lieberman attended the trial a couple of days in sympathy with the family. And so I was surprised there was a verdict, but now Netanyahu and others are calling for a pardon and essentially creating a hero out of a cold-blooded, calculating murderer. How do you see this playing out, and what are your other comments on it?
Well, yeah, Peter, thanks. Basically, I agree with you in your general view there. I would say I think this is, you know, to put it bluntly, it's a one big show, because we have to start, first of all, from appraising that this was not a one-off. This was not an aberration event in terms of the murder. Company soldiers from Azaria's, from his company, they were saying at the hearings that this happens, I quote, tons of times. There were high-ranking commanders speaking in his defense, and you know, totally spilling the beans of the most moral army in the world by saying that basically they have loads of times they have commanded their soldiers to do such things, and they hushed it up. They were literally saying this. We have to regard this was not an aberration. And we also should look back to around October 2015. I write about this too. You know, there are a whole range of politicians and security leaders who were basically talking very clearly about a shoot-to-kill policy. You know, the moment, and no one dared talk about it internationally. If anyone, like, for example, Swedish Foreign Minister Margaret Wallström, she suggested that there might be a policy of extrajudicial execution. You know, she was immediately, Netanyahu called her remarks stupid, and some, you know, high official in the high official in the education ministry, he said that maybe she should, you know, she's anti-Semitic, got anti-Semitic DNA, maybe she should get the same treatment as Bernadotte, you know, maybe someone will do that, you know, like murder Count Volker Bernadotte in 1948. Maybe someone would do that to her. But, you know, it's very clear there has been a policy of shoot to kill, and it exists. Now, what is the difference here? It was filmed. It was filmed so clearly, and it went out a day after by, you know, filmed by Al Shamsiyah, who was a B'Tselem a B'Tselem activist. And it went out the day after, and it wasn't, you couldn't control it. And you couldn't help that people saw murder as it was happening in no uncertain terms. No one could call it not murder. So they had to do something with it, because if they didn't do anything with it, the whole Israeli, those people who said that there's no justice in the Israeli military system, at least, they would be, it would be proof that they were right. You know, no one's doing anything about extrajudicial murder. So, of course, they ran a case. But, right, immediately Netanyahu said, no, our soldiers are not murderers. They ostensibly, they can't be, because they are themselves fighting against bloodthirsty terrorists. You know, that's your the propaganda, typical Netanyahu propaganda logic there. Immediately, you know, after a few days, it was just reduced to manslaughter. And, you know, in the past, at least in the past three decades, there has just not been a murder case, a murder conviction, right, in the Israeli military. I think not even a murder, you know, a murder case as such in the Israeli military. It was just like, that doesn't happen. And before that, you had murder cases, and I wrote about this. This is interesting. If you go back to like 1956, there was a big massacre. I think it was 49 people in Kafr Qasim, a quite known one. And those were actually Palestinian citizens of Israel. They were massacred just on the first day of the Suez 56 war. And there were a few murder charges there. But all of those people, with all the pardons, they got out within the most lengthy sentence that was actually served there was a year and a half. So that's what actually happened. And the commander who was actually responsible for this, he was first charged with murder, but then they exonerated him, and he was given a fine, in fact, and that fine is iconic. It resembles the historically it picturizes the value of Palestinian lives. He was given a fine of 1/10 of a Israeli lira. And this is, you know, we got this trial. So it started out with a false premise, I would say, you say, it was not even murder to begin with. So, of course, look, it was being played on a false premise on manslaughter. And of course, you know, the court had to show some semblance of logic and justice and say, okay, here was manslaughter. But then you get the show, you know, the whole movement for, you know, free Elora Azaria, the victim of political correctness. And even, I mean, this is not just Netanyahu calling for his pardon. They didn't even know what the sentence was. There was no sentence. Before the sentence, it's not only Netanyahu calling for his pardon. Even Shelly Yachimovich from the Zionist Union, the left, has called for his pardon before a sentence. So you understand, this is a kind of national mainstream feeling of, you know, there's a victim. And the only reason he's even on trial is because someone filmed him. So this guy who filmed him, Al-Shamsia, his whole area in Al-Khalil there is cordoned off. He's now a kind of prisoner in his own territory, because, you know, they have to the Israeli military has to prevent another murder. You know, they are threatening him and his family with their lives. So that's the situation there.
Yeah. Well, Jonathan, I really want to thank you for joining me today. It's been very informative. I appreciate your perspectives. And I hope to talk again here on the Peter B. Collins podcast.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Jonathan Ophir. Your feedback and comments are welcome. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you.
until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until